This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Yeah, not too bad, Chris. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad, not bad. You look really low on our little screen today. And with that chair behind you, you look a bit like a Cyberman.
I was thinking more like, I've been told I look more like the Emperor. Well, certainly when I've got a hoodie on and I've got the hood up.
I could see that. Yeah, that could make sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I was messing around with my screen and I think the camera at the top is all at the wrong angles. People keep mentioning it all day.
All right, I apologise for bringing it back up again. Anyway, somebody else is looking good on camera as our guest today. We have Matt Starr from Spectralogic. How are you doing, Matt?
Chris, I'm doing good.
Excellent. Good to see you.
Nice seeing you.
You look like you're wearing the, what is it, Ross Brawn Formula One headset, so you look like you're about to direct a Formula One race.
You know, I have guys all over the world that work for me, and it's funny that one of my guys, they all have different headsets, and one of the guys has this blue set, and I mean, it's big, and it's baby blue, and it's hard not to see the headset. That's all you see is the headset.
It's funny, isn't it? I suppose what the fun of being in lockdown and having so many remote connections and calls, I guess. So let's just talk about what we're going to talk about today and summarize where we got to in a previous podcast and explain why I thought it'd be great for getting you on to talk about the particular topic of the day. Now, a few weeks ago, Mr. Chris Meller, who's not joining us today, but at the time we were talking about Medium. I think we were talking about hard drives and we were talking about a tape and various other things just to say where the industry had got to. One of the things he pointed out was, why did tapes not wear out when the tape goes over the reels inside the cartridge and so on? And I must admit, I don't know about you, Martin, but I didn't really have an answer for that. So we thought, well, there must be so many things about tape where we are today in the industry that it's probably great to get an absolute expert on it to talk about it. So hence the reason why you are here, Matt. You are the expert.
Okay.
Not to talk about beer.
Not beer, not wine, right?
No, but tape.
Save those for after the podcast.
Absolutely, yes. Sorry, private joke there. Okay, so where should we start? I went back and started to talk about, or look at the different formats, and for me, the earliest was 3480. I think I probably used some 3420 reel-to-reel tapes. But tape's been around since like 1951 or 52 or something.
So yeah, they say 50, yeah.
So it's been around a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, and the one that I think that everybody's real used to is what's called 9-track. That's the one you see in the movies. It's the round reels. They're a half an inch thick. They're about maybe 10 inches in diameter, and they're always sitting like this, and they always move like that. That's the common data tape format from the old movies that people used to see.
Yep, and they've got the vacuum drops, haven't they? That sort of
they can have vacuum. Yeah. They can have. They don't have to have. We used to start, I mean, a cipher drive that we used to use, I used to feed up by hand. Then vacuum fed came along to auto feed it. Basically, a vacuum would draw the tape and it would spin through and flutter through and then automatically reel onto the pickup reel.
So since then, we sort of moved on to the cartridge model.
Yep.
And I think cartridge is pretty much what we're all used to now as a standard format, I think.
I don't think I've seen anything else apart from cartridges.
No.
Not anymore.
And I think that goes back to, I mean, the, you know, 9-track always was handled by hand, right? So you put the cartridge into a case when you were done with it, a wrapper, you put a write protect ring on it, and it was operated by hand. When you look at the cartridges, one of the things that came along with cartridges is some level of automation almost always. The 3480 drives had a stack unit, which was just a hopper, but it automatically kind of fed the tapes into the tape drive. It was one of the other inventions that kind of came along with that cartridge format.
Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? I mean, well, obviously, Matt, you've got a very specific reason to want to talk about feeders and hoppers and libraries because that's the nature of the business of your company. But just, that's a good point, Martin. I suppose I did know that, but I hadn't really thought about it. But that automation was something we saw in the late 80s that really changed the way that we managed and handled tapes, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I remember my first employer, I mean, they had a big tape library, but the tape library itself was built into a room. It had a robot. And the warning signs on the door, do not open, do not enter while robot's in operation, because it was a room and that robot would do you damage. And yeah, it was very, very different to, I think we still did have some reel-to-reel, but everybody was moving over to cartridge-based formats where you could have the automation, you could have the robot. And I did see it go wrong once and throw things, and that was quite amusing, but it's not...
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw one go wrong, but I do remember losing track of the database that tracked exactly where all the tapes were in the library, and then thinking, oh, we'll just open it up and we'll go and find it. You know, you open up the door and you go in and you've got stuff on the inside of the circle, and you've got stuff on the outside of the actual library itself. And then you realise you have no chance of working out where that one tape is that you want to find. Absolutely none. So you end up inventorying the library again to get yourself back. But it was a good technology at the time. And I think, as you said, Matt, that's one of the reasons that cartridges have become were brought in, as well as not physically touching the tape.
Yeah, so I go back to AT&T Bell Labs. That's where I remember seeing kind of the first automation systems. In the U.S., what happens is, in the middle of the night, your telephone will go, bing. This was in the 80s and 90s. And that little bing was them testing the line. They would send a signal out, it'd bing your phone, and they'd get a signal back. And so AT&T was tracking all this data about phone lines for predictive repair. And at the time, what they would do is have a big board up there telling people what tape in what system needs to be loaded next. And the people would run into the tape vault, get a tape, run back out. And so some of the first automation products were intercept the information going to that board and do it automatically. Put it in, you know, a robot, because the information's all there. It says take barcode 123456 and put it in drive 1 on predictor 7.
Okay. I tried to make a list of some of the formats I thought we've seen over the years, and as I said, I'm familiar with 3480 and then 3490, which is just effectively an upgrade of that. But then IBM brought out Magstar, which was, I think, nicknamed Jaguar, 3590, which I think has gone through a number of iterations.
Yeah, it's obviously still current. Yeah.
Sorry, you go, Martin?
It's still current.
Yeah, so it's still it's still going, yeah.
Names, but yeah. The format's still the same.
Yeah, and then obviously LTO, and at the bottom end, SMB, SME stuff. I picked out a few, you know, things like DLT and DAT and quarter-inch cartridge, that sort of thing. But in general, I would say that the enterprise is probably those top two now, isn't it? Magstar and LTO, you know, the Jaguar and the LTO, the sort of the leading technologies.
Yeah, and they're almost identical. I mean, the same servo track that came out of the Magstar drive, the servo track did. So that's the technology that's leading today. But previously, like you're saying, previously there were helical scan drives. You know, Ampex, of all people, built a giant helical scan drive, 300 and I want to say it was 380 meg per cartridge, and the cartridges were huge. And of course, this was 1992. But there were huge data tapes back then, and all kinds of different formats. To go, you know, to say you could count formats on one hand, it'd be hands, toes, feet, and a couple neighbors' hands, toes, feet. Just a lot of formats out there that's consolidated.
Right. So one of the things you've just highlighted there was something called helical scan, and I picked that up because I'd actually forgotten about this. I remember the very first tapes that I had or I was involved with, we'd actually know how many tracks were on there, 9-track, 18-track, 36-track, I think, for 3490. And then they'd use IDRC and they'd put it for the extra density. And then the tape would be written on the other side as well as the format normal side to increase the capacity. But the serpentine, linear, and helical, isn't that, as the three sort of main ways to record on a tape?
Yeah. And really, serpentine and linear are pretty much the same format.
Can you just explain what they are?
So helical is going to be where you have the head is a rotating drum, and it's pitched at a slight angle, usually about 17 degrees or so, and then the tape will go past that spinning head. And what that causes is, as it spins by the tape, it causes almost like a very small parabolic write track. The value in helical scan was density. It was the first time you were able to really get tracks packed very, very closely together. And so that format, then the other piece that format gave you is, when media had damage, your read after write heads were working, you could actually lay the data down in a different area on tape. So if you had a linear scratch on the tape going exactly down the tape, or a vertical scratch on the tape, it was much more easy to compensate for defective tape by just writing in a different location.
Interesting. I mean, that's a major problem, Martin, isn't it? You know, tape damage, and how many times have you had to pull that the leader out and try and refit it if you ever could?
Resetting leader was a fairly common thing to do. We even do it today. We've all got special tools to do it. You just unwind it and put it back in. But there have been various iterations of the LTO, which have been quite famous for pinging leader pins. So you just kind of use it. And it always surprised me how robust tape is. It may ping out. You might look at a tape and think it's never going to read that. It's got a big crease in it. You rewind the tape, you get the leader pin reseated, you put it in, and you generally can get that data off. And you get the data off, you copy it across, and obviously you throw your tape away. You don't want one with a crease in it. But it does surprise me how robust it is.
Yeah, and what's the reason for that, Matt?
It's just got a ton of ECC on it, so error correction. And there's a big difference between, you know, people always compare ECC and they think disk drives. There's a big difference between how much ECC is on a tape and how much extra ECC is on a tape versus a disk. So a SATA disk drive is good to about 10 to the 14th. Enterprise drive, a SAS drive, is good to about 10 to the 15th. Today's tape technology is good to 10 to the 19th. So that's where we start to error out. There's a subtle difference and maybe an important difference here, which is the ECC on a disk drive is kind of stretched like a rubber band. It is taut. It is at the bleeding edge of what it can do. And so when you get to 10 to the 15th and the ECC is fired, it's going to give you bad data. It has corrected, but it has miscorrected, and the data is coming up to you and it's wrong. This is why you now see RAID stacks and erasure coding systems above that are actually doing checksums across the entire RAID stack or the RAID stripe, because so much data is being written, we actually need to now check that the stripe, the data that gave us, was good. Tape, on the other hand, today will not give you bad data till 10 to the 33rd. So that's five times the life of the Earth. If you wrote a million tape drives at full speed all day, it's five times the life of the Earth. In other words, the possibility of bad data, incorrect data coming off tape is, well, it's nil. It may have an unable to correct, but that's different than giving you bad data.
Okay. That's an amazing statistic to think that we're at the level where, unless you physically bash that tape off the table or you scratch it with something deliberately or you deliberately damage it, as long as you're looking after that media, it's going to give you consistent results continuously. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, and it's just, again, surface area. So you look at a hard disk drive and you think about a 3.5-inch platter. Right, so we take a 3.5-inch platter. We can't use the center. Let's just say 1.25 inches of that center part of that. Let's just say, 20 millimeters in the center there. But as we get there, we have only so much area. Tape in itself is 1 kilometer long. Today's LT08 has 208 tracks down and back. So in theory, you're talking about a 208-kilometer run down that tape. That's a lot of bits. So the bits, A, are bigger, and we have a lot more room for a lot more ECC.
Do you know, it's tempting just to get a tape, and I wonder if I've still got any LTO lying around, and undo it and see how far we can stretch. It'd be interesting to see, actually. But that's amazing, isn't it? Kilometers in the tape.
There's a kilometer. Yeah, there's a kilometer.
And it just shows you how thin the physical tape itself must be and strong. So that must be one of the, I guess, if you look at, say, hard drive manufacturers and the amount of effort they put into getting the bit density into the actual platter and making that reliable and the ability to write to it, for tape, it's all about the quality of the physical tape, isn't it? And just making that resilient.
Yeah. The coercivity of the tape really is what's going to determine the strength of the bit over time. So the more coercivity you have in there, the higher coercivity, you need a little bit more energy, but then also the bit's going to last a lot longer as far as from a decay standpoint.
Okay, that makes me think of one other question, which is sort of related to what Chris mentioned the last time he was on, and something I think we'd thought of, and I think we discussed it, Martin, but that's just the size of the read and write head, because on a hard drive, it has to be, the technology going into a hard drive to read and write on the size of the tracks that they're using is incredible. But you just said there's only 208 tracks on a tape, so you're not having to make a super micro head like you would have done on a hard drive.
Yeah, so the heads today are about 1996, maybe 2000, year 2000 disk drive technology. So I always say 15 to 20 years behind what's being pushed as the cutting edge for disk drives. So if you look at LT06, that was GMR, giant magnetoresistive. Now we're at TMR, tunnel magnetoresistive. Tunnel magnetoresistive is that time where we turn the head. Think about perpendicular recording on disk drives. That's kind of where we're just getting to now on tape. It's not aligned, particle aligned yet, but the head is that turned head.
Does that mean we can expect to see significant improvements and continuous growth in this? And I'll mention this because this was another thing, Martin, that we talked about at the time with Chris, and that was the LTO generations. And I think we were talking about the sort of the multiplier effect, weren't we, and where that was and what we were expecting and where we were with LTO9.
I mean, if you you just look at the multipliers and you look at the roadmap for 12, I mean, it's crazy amounts of data potentially, but yeah.
Yeah, and that goes back to what happened in the hard disk world. You know, when TMR came out in hard drives, they were able to double very quickly because the technology was sitting there. Now all they had to do is, you know, bring down track pitch, tighten up the head, fly a little closer, and the bits got smaller.
Okay, we'll talk about formats in a minute, but I just want to, before I forget, ask the question that Chris asked at the time. And I guess this is a view you have because you haven't really thought through or know what the technology looks like. But when we started talking about 3420, that idea of the tape being fed through spool reels and, you know, like you see on the TV and films from many years ago, I think we had an assumption that tape still flies over or touches the read-write head. And we were trying to work out why the tape doesn't wear out. Now, I remember when I was using the original 3480, 3490 and Magstar drives, there was always the issue of shoe shining, which they weren't supposed to have as much of a problem as, say, LTO. But is that still really the way that tape works, that it goes over sort of reels and so on?
So let's talk about the disk drive first, because I think Chris mentioned that the disk drive, he talked about, you know, fly height of the head.
Yes, yeah.
Right. Well, what keeps the head from flying? What's making the head fly?
Isn't it?
Exactly. Yep. You have a platter spinning. It's drawing air in. And here's, if my hand were the head, it's drawing air in and it's pulling it under that head and flying it up. Right. And so tape has the exact same principle once it's at speed. So once we start tape and we bring it to speed, the tape is the moving piece of material. It has a eddy that's being drawn into that head and then flying the head. Now, fly height's very, very important from a density standpoint for reliability. So that tension on the tape is what really determines fly height. So what we're trying to do is we're going to tension the tape to a certain point. The looser the tension, the higher the fly height, the greater the tension, the lower the fly height. And then the speed, of course, slightly changes the fly height. So it is a very dynamic system where you're pulling at the same time you're trying to check what your signal to noise ratio is off your servo.
Okay.
Again, technology from a disk drive, a lot of it is technology from a disk drive.
Yeah. And that sort of implies that when you want to do any sort of reading or writing, as soon as the tension drops, you're lifting the head away to try and make sure you're not damaging the head, I guess. Is that the way it's going to work?
Yeah. So what's going to happen? Same principles here. So let's take a disk drive again, which is disk drives have a capacitive circuit inside of the system, which is if a disk drive loses motor and loses power mid-write, the potential energy stored in that rotating disk is actually used to power the system to get the heads off the platters.
Right.
This goes back to a head crash that we all kind of think about in the 80s and things. That was what a head crash was. Disk drives have learned how to, you know, basically develop energy that wasn't there before to pull the heads away.
Okay.
Same kind of things with a tape. We would hate to have a tape die in the middle, but what would happen is if you lost power on a tape, they're going to start to release tension on the drive itself so that we don't basically kind of mangle up the tape right there. And then when they power back on, they're going to realize they're mid-tape and they're going to do a very slow rewind back to BOT to protect the tape.
Okay, excellent. Let's talk about the modern formats then. And Martin, from your perspective, are you an LTO shop full stop? Is that your current technology?
Yeah, we're an LTO shop. I think we're about to put our first eights in. We're not up to nine yet. We've looked at IBM TS in the past, and we looked at the T1000s and the storage tape formats, but LTO seems to become relatively ubiquitous outside of the mainframe, I would say. So about right, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah, so we see the T10,000 and the Jaguar drive a little bit in HPC, but yeah, a lot on mainframe because there is limited support for mainframe and LTO.
Yeah, good point, yeah. So is there any reason why those percentages are like that other than LTO being, I don't know, is it cheaper? Are the drives cheaper? I know Storage Tech used to be like the most expensive drives you could buy in the entire world from when I remember deploying any. But, you know, what's determined the sort of percentage on the breakdown apart from the mainframe, perhaps?
for me, what we see is, yeah, LTO is the most cost-effective, both initial purchase and long-term investment. The media has two media suppliers, so there's competition, and the media price continues to drop. Where when you're in the enterprise, you have a pretty flat price, maybe with a half a percent per quarter drop, something like that, maybe 1% per quarter drop. Where LTO, you can see, you know, 5% or more per quarter in a drop. The drives are physically less. There's physically more of them. I would say it's, you know, you could say it's 80-20, 90-10 in drive shipments. Where the Jaguar drive does play is, we talked about mainframe. It has special features in it for mainframe. It has, yep, a directory structure that mainframe software uses. It's also a bit of a playground. If IBM chooses and they have something special they want to put in the tape drive, for example, the first tape drive that they came out with Ethernet was their Jaguar drive. So they put Ethernet in that Jaguar drive. It's just a faster development platform for them because it's not in the consortium's envelope. So they can kind of use it and play around with it and test out a technology there. And then decide if it's going to come back to LTO or not. Maybe like Toyota Racing Development, right? TRD for, okay, Toyota.
Yeah. So apart from, of course, Martin, if, as we said last week, if IBM decide to hive off that part of their business and that they're not in the hardware business anymore, then maybe they won't be doing tape, but we don't really know the answer to that one. I can't imagine them getting rid of it, can you?
Not yet. No, I can't see. Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to them. It seems... there's so much development in that background there that you'd think they'd hold on to it for now. Okay.
And I'm sure it's probably governmental regulations and God knows what with these, because of these. Because remember, tape formats are a long-term archival.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just too much written today for... if IBM sold it, someone would be buying it because there's long legs in tape right now.
So that's where I wanted to go next to, in this whole use case thing. Now, in the, gosh, would you say late 90s? We move towards the idea of using disk for backup. We started to move away from tape when we saw DDN coming, not DDN, when we saw data domain. Yeah, yeah, too many letters. The first two were correct, the third one was wrong. Then when data domain came to the market, we saw very much a move towards disk-based backup. So maybe you want to answer this first, Martin. Maybe then, Matt, you know, you can give your opinion. But I'd be interested, Martin, to understand, are you pretty much using tape exclusively for archive now? What would you still use it for backup, or do you think that's long gone?
Okay, so we still use it for backup. We have some environments which go to tape. We have environments which go to tape because we want to encrypt it and we'll want to remove it from the library for reasons, and it's a lot harder to do with hard drives. But generally our big environments are our active archive environments. We argue that it's not a strict archive, it's not cold. All that data is warm, so in many ways we treat it like midline disk. Because we're dealing with big media files, we're streaming off in serialized formats. It's ideal for that.
But, and I guess you've got big files anyway, so you know, in proportion, yeah, to the size of the tape, you're not storing millions of files on a tape.
Well, as the tapes get bigger, yes. I mean, at one point we would certainly at the stage where we were at a file, almost a file per tape, even when it was about 1.5 terabytes. So it's not a huge amount of HD video.
Yeah.
It's getting better now.
Okay, fair enough. And you think that makes sense, Matt? Do you agree with that?
The part about switching to disk, I think we have seen, especially in the small to mid-range market, there's a disk-based backup. I think maybe a little bit of a pitch backwards back to tape with the ransomware coming around. There's been two or three announcements recently where, you know, that's what you go after, by the way. You know, the ransomware guys go after your database, and the next thing they do is hit your backup server, because if you have backups and they can lock those down, then you need to pay the ransom.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good point. I guess there is a trade-off, though, because we know that, you know, you've got to physically manage the media. Although you could put it in a library, and you sell some very lovely libraries. I've walked the length of your... Have you still got that big library installed?
We don't have it installed down there. We may build another one here shortly.
Okay. We'll see. How many units was that long? That was huge, wasn't it?
That was 44. We just announced 45. So that was 1 exabyte of data in that library today.
I will use that picture as the heading for this particular episode, because that is such a great picture to be able to see the length of it. And I think there might have been one where we had a couple of people in for proportion just to show it. But yeah, that was an amazing setup. Single arm archive as well. Didn't that, how many robots did it have in it? Must have only
had two robots in it. Going, they ran at about 80 inches per second, so just about 2 meters per second.
Okay, that's pretty quick. I've lost my train of thought now. Where was I? I was talking about, I guess, the challenge of managing tape compared to other media. You know, there is a bit of an overhead, but of course, as you said, we're now starting to see some of the benefits of actually thinking about using techniques like that tape to protect against ransomware and so on. But I would imagine as organizations create more and more data, they may well decide that tape is a great backup / archive location simply because of the cost-effective side of it.
Yeah. Well, especially for archive. I mean, if you look at media and entertainment, genomics, HPC, the people who create data as their business, in other words, the ones and zeros are not a byproduct. They may be video content. They may be simulations off the HPC. They may be genomic scans. That data can't be thrown away, or in most cases can't be thrown away, and they need to keep it cost-effectively. So tape ends up being the storage choice.
Yeah. And I'd be really interested to know, you might be not be allowed to say as an insight, but I'm assuming we all think that the public cloud providers are using tape somewhere.
You can just do a search and find out the truth. There's enough news articles about what they use. And some of the articles include where and when they use tape.
Okay.
There was a video, Chris, some 2 or 3 years ago, maybe a bit longer than that, of a Google data center, and it was, they had tape drives.
Okay.
Because they showed all the tape libraries.
Right. So. But has anybody ever actually officially said, we use tape? I don't think they have they? I've never seen anything as a statement to say we use it.
I think it was known that Google ended up going back to tape when they had a big Gmail lost, I seem to remember.
That's true. I suppose we know they must have done that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can look at some ways to maybe cover this is look at the SLAs, that they're often on the coldest tiers, and then look at the cost structure for that coldest tier. And if you compared it to technologies out there today, if you were to buy that commodity technology, be it a hard drive, be it a tape drive, which one matches pretty closely? When is the payoff within a year or two? And pretty quickly you see which technology is used.
Yeah, I think that gives it away.
You can pre-buy recovery slots and things like that. So I'm assuming that's how they're doing it. They're giving you some reservation on their tape libraries as well.
Okay. So I think that, you know, at the end of the day, I think tape could have had a bit of a bad press for quite a long time simply because people were very much of the opinion, nah, don't use tape. Tape's, I mean, you know, the age-old tape's dead. I can see why tape stopped being used for backup. Let's call it backup, not long-term protection, but backup. Because, you know, speed of recovery and being able to recover individual files, and there's a parallel issue there that when a drive's being used for one purpose, you can't be using it to restore another set of data. So there's a parallelism thing there. But in general, I would say that tape has a very strong future going forward.
I certainly think so. That's part of, you know, why we're in this business is I see from a data growth rate, I see that, you know, the customer base is maybe less customers than I had 10 years ago or less customers than I had 20 years ago, but the data sets are 10x what I had, you know, so we're going to these customers now that instead of having, I have 50 terabytes, how do I back it up? It's I have 5 petabytes going to 50 petabytes, or I have 500 petabytes going to an exabyte.
And you must see that all the time, Martin. I mean, you know, you're sort of nodding there. I guess from your perspective, your data growth must be crazy.
It is. And obviously in the world of media, we're doing more UHD. We know that 8K will come along. And we see the size of those files. You could put them in the cloud, obviously, and give it somebody else's problem. But eventually probably ends up a tape, or you keep it locally on premises on your own tape. Because as I joke with vendors, I really can't afford to cover the whole of the southeast of England in a data centre and fill it full of hard drives. It's not practical. So tape is the best way of doing it. Once it's written to a tape, it sits in a slot. It's not burning power, doesn't need spinning. It's the best media for this. And actually, I was thinking, what we've seen from a backup point of view, backup of individual machines has really gone away in a lot of companies. You would never do a bare metal restore from disk or from tape. You will reprovision. So what we're seeing now is backup and archive is about data. It's not about machines.
I'd agree with that. And I think, funny enough, I posted something today talking about data-centric architectures. And I do think that's definitely where we're headed, that we shouldn't be thinking about backup of all the stuff and all the encumbrances around that application. You know, we should be thinking about just protecting the data itself. So that makes complete sense, you know, that that's the way we should be going. However, so I would like to just sort of finish on one thing. and ask, what do we think the future is, Matt? Where, bearing in mind everything you said so far, the technology clearly is super reliable. You know, we're narrowing down to a small number of vendors that are selling this stuff. Is the future simply just bigger capacity drives and greater throughput? I mean, is that it? Or can we see anything else on the horizon?
So from a general aspect, what I would say is what has to happen in tape, and you'll see this is in feature sets as tape generations come out, is we have to improve or at least keep flat the time to data. How long does it take to get to that first byte? A tape is very fast once you're streaming. I mean, you can pull specs for LT09 if you search them today. They're not public, but if you search them, you may find specs for LT09 today. So you have a large tape and you have a very fast tape drive, but it takes somewhere between, let's just say, a minute to a minute and 30 to get to that data. So we need to improve that. And then the second thing, you guys brought this up, is Barton writes, you know, 1.5 terabyte files. Well, we have other customers that have 1 gig files, right? And they may go hit a tape and say, I need 100 of these back, 100 of these 1 gig files back. I don't want to be bouncing around that tape kind of randomly. I need to do that in a more ordered area arrangement. So what's the fastest way to get that off? And if you think about disk drives from the past, because again, why reinvent the wheel? Disk drives had this thing called a scatter gather list, which was, I'll go a little farther back. I used to know the head sectors and cylinders of a disk drive, and that's how I wrote my file format or my file system. Then what I did is I pushed that technology to the disk drive so it could actually fake the mapping and do whatever it wanted. And I gave it a list of blocks I want. Give me these blocks. And it would do it whatever order it was efficient. And now we're doing that with tape. So you're going to see technologies coming out in tape to improve especially recovery of data sets, because it's already fast for write. On the write side, you know, most people are taking large chunks of data and pushing them out and archiving them off, right? They're done with them. They're going to archive them. It's when they say that somebody died and I need to get as much content back out of the archive about that person because an event has happened, that's when we need to make tape a little faster, more efficient maybe.
So from your perspective, you sell a number of products that have front-ended tape libraries in the past. What's the status with those? And is that sort of what you're referring to as part of this?
So I was referring to the actual tape drive technology. That's right, inside the tape drive that it can do. But the software itself that's talking to the tape drive has to be aware of that. So it would have to, just like a SCSI scatter gather list, I have to be aware of this technology in the tape drive that I say, here's a list of 100 files I need off that tape. Please give me the best order to recover them. And I need to do that handshake with the tape drive. Product wise, I think that my take is going to be that I think that what you're going to see is we did object to tape about 5 years ago. I think you're going to start seeing object to tape becoming a little bit more commonplace for people. We've already done file system to tape where we have HSMs. That's been a proven technology for a long time. Now you're going to start seeing more vendors come in with object to tape, S3 put get nomenclatures. The reason is because it fits, right?
Yeah.
You're archiving, put it, get it. So I think you'll see that coming to the market soon. And I think you're going to start seeing some storage lifecycle management products coming where it really is not just HSM, but actually let's look at your data, do some reporting. Think of like SRMs of a few years back with data movement capabilities so that you can actually manage your content and get it to the archive.
Okay, interesting.
And Media and Entertainment already has these. It's general IT or other industries that may lack them. Media and Entertainment, along with HPC, has been way, way ahead in their data management.
Yeah, you've had that already for a long time, haven't you, Martin? You've talked about your sort of front ending of the media before, I think.
Yeah, we do. It always makes us laugh. This is crossover between HPC and media and entertainment, and we're seeing a general IT coming along saying we've got this problem with it, and well, that's a solved problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just shocking that you know, you look at an object storage system, which is a database and data storage. And what is a MAM or a DAM in media and entertainment? It's exactly that, a database that tells you where that asset is.
Okay, interesting. So if people would like to find out more about what, well, you personally, Matt, yeah, they may be interested in your beer and winemaking prowess, or they may be interested in the technology that you look after, where should we point them in terms of both you and the company?
So SpectraLogic.com has a lot of information on backup and archive data systems. There's a lot of partnerships up there that you can certainly find. Me, I'm up there too, listed. I don't have a wine or a beer site to point you to. That's for home consumption.
Do people follow you on Twitter? Do you have a Twitter handle people could find you there?
Yeah, it's the Star Files.
Okay, perfect. We'll make sure we include that. Well, I thought that was really interesting, and I think we should just throw it out there. And if people have got any questions on tape, we should get them to send them in, and then we could always just try and get them answered. But I think that really sort of shows you where the direction is and what's happening. But I think, yeah, it'd be interesting to see when LTO 10, 11, 12 comes out, how people are going to manage those going forward. But for now, Matt, thanks very much for joining us, and catch up with you soon.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Thanks, Martin.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.